freedom of speech and religion are important rights for Christians because we are called to lift up Jesus.
Finnish lawmaker Dr. Paavi Rossinen talking about her presentation at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
I have been a member of the Parliament of Finland for 27 years, but now, suddenly, I'm facing 3 criminal charges for sharing my deeply held beliefs based on the Bible. At the trial, the prosecutor tried to deny the core message of the Bible, the teaching of law and gospel. I defend the right to confess the Christian faith and its teaching on the human being.
You can meet and hear Dr. Paavi Rossinen at the 2022 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Had been bipartisan early on, support for a woman's right to choose. The science hasn't changed, but the court changed.
Science has advanced so much to the point that it reveals the undeniable humanity of the unborn child from the moment of fertilization all the way up until birth.
The political solutions are always going to be limited to political problems, but the real problem that we have is the problem of the wicked human heart, and that's a problem that only God can fix.
We see our congregations as places of refuge from the chaos and madness of this world, and we welcome all people to turn from sin, to look to Christ, and to have the peace that passes all understanding.
Seminarians from Concordia Theological Seminary love listening to Issues Etc. or driving to their fieldwork congregations on Sunday morning.
We agree that there is great unrest, political, societal, moral, spiritual, in our country. We disagree as to the cause, and yet if we simply look at the numbers, if we examine what has been trending almost out of existence, not only in the lower portions of our economy, but up into the middle class, we see undeniable evidence that fatherlessness is a factor, maybe the factor, in the unrest, especially among our youth. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, June 17th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about social unrest and fatherlessness with Dr. Stephen Baskerville, Professor of State Studies at the Collegium Intermarium in Warsaw, Poland. We'll spend some time with Jeff Hammer discussing fatherhood. He's authored the book Man Up. And then Patty Knapp, a certified pregnancy care counselor on Long Island, joins us to talk about pro-choice attacks on crisis pregnancy centers. Joining us to discuss social unrest and fatherlessness, Dr. Stephen Baskerville. He's professor of state studies at the Collegium Intermarium in Warsaw, Poland, author of several books, including his latest, A Gentleman's Guide to Manners, Sex, and Ruling the World, and a recent column for Chronicles magazine titled Revolt of the Fatherless. Dr. Baskerville, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Why do so many conservative elites, why are they unable to provide answers to society's disintegration?
That's a very good question. And yes, I do address that in some recent articles. I think maybe one of the most obvious glaring problems is the complete lack of any kind of self-criticism. Since the left effectively took power in the United States 2 years ago, there's been almost no self-criticism discussion about why this happened, who allowed it to happen. What did we do wrong, conservatives? Who was asleep at the switch? Who allowed this to happen? There's been almost none of this. And any attempt to ask these kind of questions meets with a kind of very strong authoritarianism, a very strong intolerance on the right. Paul Gottfried says this, a very strong conservative writer. He says that the American right is very authoritarian. They don't like to have any kind of dissenting opinions, and they have basically a cancel culture of their own. And I think he's very right about that. I mean, I know a number of colleagues of mine who have been dismissed from jobs, especially in universities or seminaries or journalism, because they have views that are impeccably conservative, but they don't fit in with the boilerplate, the standard conservatism that wants to maintain its orthodoxy. I think there's a great hierarchy. I think the conservative world is very hierarchical. There's another thing, which is not limited to conservatives, but it certainly does extend to them, and that is, you know, what I call the iron law of Washington. And that is that anybody who is paid to address a problem, whether it's a bureaucrat or some other government official or a lobbyist or a political activist or a non-governmental organization or a politician, anybody who's paid to solve a problem immediately develops a self-interest in perpetuating the problem they're supposed to be solving. Because if you solve the problem, you're redundant. You have no reason to exist anymore. So, you know, this is the culture of Washington. You pretend to solve the problems. You raise money claiming that you're going to solve problems. And then you spend the money at your leisure. And this happens on the left and it happens on the right.
You ask the question, why is the left winning? How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, these are the reasons, I argue. I like to think that, you know, in some ways, I often say the left didn't do anything differently. It was the right. It was the right that fell asleep at the switch. It was the conservatives who should be looking inside themselves and seeing, you know, what did we do wrong? But that's not quite true. There is something, and I think that the real innovative kind of politics on the left in recent years has been the sexual politics. I think that is really the new kid on the block, so to speak, the new dimension of political dynamics, which conservatives don't know how to deal with. They just do not know how to address sexual politics, especially feminist politics. They want to reduce everything to communism. They want to say, oh, the feminists and the LGBT, you know, it's really just a variation on communism. It's cultural Marxism. And they go on and on about cultural Marxism. And it's like they want to fight the Cold War again, because the Cold War, you know, they won. We won the Cold War, and it makes us feel good that we won the Cold War. So we want to go back to that. We feel like we're in control. And there's some truth in that. I mean, the radical sexual left did come out of Marxism historically. But it becomes an excuse. It becomes an excuse for not facing it. And, you know, the feminist left and the other sexual left has come up with new forms of politics, new dynamics that conservatives don't really know how to attack. You know, the old saying about fighting, you know, generals who want to fight the previous war. And that's kind of what's happening.
You say that the crash of civilization is, in essence, the revolt of adolescence. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is. If you look at what's happened in the last 2 years, starting with the death of George Floyd and then the riots that took place after that and the mass demonstrations, a lot of this was perpetrated by young people, by adolescents, not surprisingly. And a lot of it was perpetrated by older people with a very adolescent mentality, a very youthful, sometimes rebellion that often lacks any kind of direction, just rebelliousness for the sake of rebelliousness. And this is something that is expected of youth to some extent. I mean, young people go through this in adolescence. They become rebellious. The difference today is there's a strong difference today, though. If you look back, you know, when I was young in the 1960s and 70s, we were revolting against our elders. We were revolting against parental authority. We were revolting against all authority. We were standing up for our parents. We were demanding to be in charge, or at least demanding to be listened to. I took part in that too. I'm as guilty as anyone back in the 60s and 70s. Today, the difference, though, you know, what's happened in the meantime is not just that young people are revolting against their elders. Many of them have no parental authority to begin with. Large numbers of young people today have grown up without any real family structure. Many of them, millions, tens of millions, have grown up without fathers. That's the basic thing. And, you know, if you look at the statistics, the social science on that, it's irrefutable that the vast majority of social pathologies, and I mean violent crime, substance abuse, truancy, poor school performance, and more unwed pregnancy, all of this is attributable to fatherless homes, to homes without fathers, and sometimes without mothers as well, effectively. But you can go further than that. It's not just crime and that kind of, it's all forms of rebellion and violence. The same thing as we've seen recently with school shooters and mass shooters almost invariably come from homes that are fatherless and without families. The same is true of terrorists. You can see this in terrorists communities in, like, for example, the south of in the banlieue of Paris, in the north of England and other Western European countries, where you have large numbers of immigrant youth who are growing up without parents as well. The West Bank of Palestine, for example, the Palestinian communities are very much communities without any fathers, run by mothers. grandmothers. So the youth today are not just, they're not just rebelling like we did in the 60s and 70s. Many of them have no direction, no understanding of what it means to grow up in a home with a, you know, with a father, sometimes not even with a mother, because when the father is removed, the mother, you know, becomes dysfunctional. Effectively, oftentimes the children are raised effectively by welfare officials who they look to as kind of parental figures. So the normal adolescent rebellion, which we, you know, is normal, but it's usually we have ways of keeping it under control and channeling it into constructive habits of life, because adolescents are always discontented with the way the world is. And you know, they've got to be taught how to channel their discontents into, especially the intelligent ones, the more intelligent ones and the ones that are, you know, halfway educated. They tend to be the most rebellious, and that needs to be channeled into constructive life habits so it doesn't just tear down the civilization. And yet, that's precisely what's happening today.
How and why have the media been so cooperative in this revolt?
That's a good question. It's very odd, isn't it? I mean, the media has had a left-wing bias for decades, of course, but it's so flagrant today. I mean, the media are just, they've always, in the past, they at least pretended to be watchdogs, and now they're just complete lapdogs when it comes to government policy. And I think that there's a number of reasons for this. If you look at things like the area that I write about, family breakdown, family politics, the media have for a long time, there's been a media blackout on the really serious aspects of that. And so that's part of the training for this, their current apathy and fecklessness. In recent decades, media reporters and producers have become younger. They've become, you know, many of them, anybody who's worked in television or been interviewed on television, you meet these producers, they're fresh out of university. They're very inexperienced, but they're very oftentimes very ideological. Many of them come out of I've taught many of them, by the way, in political science programs and also in journalism and sometimes fields like women's studies and so forth. They come out of these kind of fields. So they come out of fields where they're indoctrinated into very politicized, you know, ideological disciplines, like, you know, again, political science, journalism. But especially journalism, I think they don't really get any background in things like history and philosophy and the really, really substantive. They don't really get a substantive education. They get an education in, you know, how to, the nuts and bolts of being a journalist. And, you know, this combined with their increasing youth and their lack of experience and their ideological indoctrination in universities, it makes these people very manipulable. I think a lot of these young journalists are very manipulable by the state. They're easily led by the nose. It is very disturbing. They tend to be, you know, again, I've taught many of them, and I've taught conservative ones too in conservative institutions. So it's not just the left ones. And the conservative ones are, you know, many of them have good values on the whole. But they also have this, I detect a sense of, you know, self-righteousness. And frankly, media is a field where a young person can acquire a lot of unaccountable power very young in life. The media has a lot of power, and they're not answerable to anybody. And a young graduate, you know, 24, 25, coming out of the universities with a journalism degree, convinced that they know everything, they can easily become intoxicated with their own power and their own righteousness. And I think that's what happens.
We're talking about social unrest and fatherlessness. Dr. Stephen Baskerville is our guest. On the other side, we will talk about the systemic destruction of families. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
The images of the war in Ukraine that have filled our screens over the last few months have left many people wondering, how do we address this as Lutherans? How do we think about war? How does the church, or can the church, speak to the state at such a time? Well, if you've asked such questions, you need to pick up the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness. There we ask and answer these very questions. To find out more, visit cph.org/witness or our website, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Clear, concise, consistent. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Memoria Press exists to promote and impart the classical heritage of the Christian West through an emphasis on the liberal arts and the great works of the Western tradition. The Memoria Press curriculum encourages the development of wisdom and virtue through the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR22. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com.
Welcome back. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about social unrest and fatherlessness with Dr. Stephen Baskerville. He's author of a recent column for Chronicles Magazine titled Revolt of the Fatherless. Dr. Baskerville, if you would describe what you call the systemic destruction of families.
Yeah, that's a very important question, and I write about that quite a lot. The family is a big priority for conservatives and for Christians, and they talk about it a lot in the conservative media. But there's an awful lot of just, you know, lamenting and bemoaning, as I call it. They don't look at the concrete issues of what is destroying the family, and especially they don't look at government policies. If you look at what's causing family breakdown in our society today, it's overwhelmingly government policies. And this means that it's susceptible to remedies. You can change bad government policies. But when you attribute it all to culture and nebulous trends and you know, impersonal forces and all this, all you do is create paralysis. You lead people to despair, and they throw their hands up and they say, you know, well, what can we do about this? What do I mean by destructive policies? Well, it's very clear. The most destructive, first of all, chronologically, the most destructive government policy for the family is the welfare system. There's no two ways about it. The welfare system has been destroying families for years. It has decimated the black family and other minority and low-income families, and increasingly it's moving into the middle-class white families as well. I'll explain that in a moment. The welfare system has just had a devastating impact. And if you look back a few decades, conservative scholars investigated this. They were, at one time in the 60s and in the 70s, scholars and journalists, some liberals as well as conservatives, they saw that the welfare system was a disaster building, and there were extensive investigations. Daniel Patrick Moynihan's famous report in 1965 on the black family is the most famous, but if you look at scholars like Irving Lewis Horowitz, and later on Charles Murray, and a number of them were working in various areas. But even liberal journalists, Daniel Shore, and who were some of the others who did reports for CBS on the decimation of the black family in the 60s and 70s. So there was an awareness that the welfare system was a disaster waiting to happen, and that what was happening in the inner cities was spreading gradually out elsewhere. And there were battle zones. There were war zones, and it wasn't getting any better. Well, why did they drop this? Why did the conservative scholars and neoconservative intellectuals give up on this? There was Bill Clinton's 1996 welfare reform, but I don't think anybody really was fooled by that into thinking it was effective. It was all undone by Obama later on. Anyway, so this problem has not gone away. It's only gone worse. In fact, what's happened is that the welfare devastation has spread to the middle class largely through divorce and because of no-fault divorce. And the same administrative system that throws fathers out of their home under the welfare system is now throwing fathers out of their home because of the divorce, middle-class fathers, because of divorce. And the industries, the feminist-driven industries that grew up under welfare, that grew up in the social work bureaucracies, like domestic violence and child abuse and the child support system, all of which makes family devastation worse, all of it. These have spread from the low-income welfare families to the middle-class families, and these same bureaucrats that were destroying families and removing fathers from their homes under welfare are now doing the same thing under divorce and using the family courts is the other institution. It's both the welfare bureaucracies and the family court system. So these government policies are deliberately destroying families. They could not be more directly antithetical to the family. This was recognized again 50, 60 years ago when scholars started looking at this. They were pointing this out, you know, the man outside the house rule. This has never been remedied. So on the one hand, you know, it sounds horrible. But on the other hand, you know, if we did pay attention to these destructive government policies, they're fairly straightforward things that could be done to remedy them. You identify the pernicious policies and you change them. And the two I would say that are the most, for the sake of brevity, are the welfare system, which has to be addressed. I mean, it just cannot be ignored any longer. And secondly, no-fault divorce, which is an abomination to the legal system. I mean, the very concept of no-fault justice is a contradiction in terms. It's antithetical to the whole concept of due process of law and to the English common law that has protected our freedom and our rights for centuries. So these things have to be addressed, and none of the conservative organizations, including those who describe themselves as pro-family and defending the family, none of them address these issues. The churches do not address these issues. Conservative media do not address these issues. And so this is why, and I believe this is not just the reason for the havoc in the inner cities and elsewhere in the country. I believe it is the reason for the takeover. It is what allowed the far left to overrun the United States government 2 years ago, starting with the George Floyd death. It is what sunk conservatism into a state of atrophy and allowed the radical left to take over.
You say that fatherlessness already accounts for every social pathology among the young. What particular pathologies are you talking about?
Well, you name it. It's all, and this is something that I don't dwell on too much because it is well accepted. Among even conservatives have pointed this out and do so on a regular basis. So, I mean, if you look at violent crime, if you look at substance abuse, truancy, dropouts, the next generation of unwed childbearing, again, school shootings, mass shootings, terrorism itself, all of these things are directly attributable. And some people try to say, no, it's because of poverty, it's because of race. But no, there have been studies very clearly controlling for poverty, controlling for low income, and controlling for race. And all of the fatherlessness is the single, by far, and ask any policeman, it is the explanatory factor behind all these social ills, far more important than poverty, far more important than race. And again, this is accepted, I think, many conservatives say. I found 6-8 articles about the shooting, you know, the recent shooting in Texas. And they all said the single most important cause of all this, if you look at it statistically, is fatherlessness. So that part is recognized. But then the conservative writers, they throw their hands up and they say, well, but there's nothing we can do about this. It's just fatherlessness. This strikes me as just utter madness. I mean, there are things we can do about it, very concrete and very straightforward things to do. They won't be easy politically. They'll run into huge opposition from feminists, from bar associations, from welfare bureaucracies, from a psychotherapy industry. But as far as the actual mechanisms we need to bring these problems under control, they're not complicated. They're very straightforward.
What particularly can be done about all of this?
Well, there's a couple things that could be done. First of all, I think, again, the welfare system has to be looked at. It's an absurdity. The welfare system is enormously expensive. It's so bloated and so out of control as far as spending. But even the money that is spent on the welfare system is only a small amount of the problem, because what you're spending money on is you're spending money to turn children into criminals and drug addicts and dropouts and single mothers. So you're spending money to create social pathologies, and then those social pathologies, they cost money, money for law enforcement, for incarceration, for education, for health care, for housing. The welfare system is not just destructive, it's not just expensive and bloated and pointless in itself. It causes more social problems, which cause more financial, bring more financial costs. So it's insane to be spending taxpayers' money to create social problems, which cost more taxpayers' money. So the first thing that has to be done is that. Now, the welfare system is a big problem, and it's not going to be attacked quickly. But I think the first step would be the most recent manifestation, and that is the system of no-fault divorce. And that could be changed actually quite easily. And all you have to do is recognize that no-fault justice, again, is an oxymoron. You cannot have no-fault justice. What no-fault justice did was it allowed innocent people to be summoned to court and to be punished, to bring the full force of the legal penal system against innocent people, people that you acknowledge to be innocent, people that are charged with no legal wrongdoing, either criminal or civil. They are summoned to court, and they are issued with directives for which they can be legally punished with incarceration. And, I mean, this is madness. I mean, it's an old principle of the common law that innocent people have a right to be left alone. Just the other night, I heard Tucker Carlson say that. He defined due process of law in terms of habeas corpus. He said, if you're incarcerated, you have to be charged with a crime. Well, no, not under no-fault justice. You don't. No-fault justice means precisely the opposite. You can be incarcerated without being charged with any crime, without a presumption of innocence, without a formal charge, without a jury, without double jeopardy, without any of the protections that accused criminals have in criminal court. And again, I don't say it will be politically easy, because it will run into opposition from the bar associations and the feminists and the judges and the social workers. But in terms of the actual mechanism, it would cost absolutely nothing. It would be very straightforward to bring fault back into all judicial proceedings, which has to be part of the mix. It wouldn't cost the taxpayers a dime. So I think those are the two biggest things that are being neglected and cannot be neglected any longer. No-fault justice, no-fault divorce, and the welfare system.
This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Baskerville about his column, Revolt of the Fatherless. Faith Lutheran High School in Plano, Texas provides an education firmly rooted in the Word of God, classical Lutheran curriculum, and a commitment to nurturing graduates who serve their neighbor in church and state. They offer both residential and online classes for high school students worldwide. Learn more at flsplano.org. Faith Lutheran School, Plano, Texas, flsplano.org. When we come back, we'll go into more detail on something he just mentioned, fatherlessness finding its way into the middle class.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial-A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial-A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Hi, this is Pastor Eric Lang of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Gresham, Oregon. One thing I've asked of the Lord, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in His temple. Mount Hood, Multnomah Falls, the Oregon coast. Oregon is beautiful. but nothing compares to the beauty of the Lord's house. If you are vacationing in the Portland area, please come join us at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Gresham, where the liturgy lives and God's people worship as one. For more information, go to wheretheliturgylives.org.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're discussing social unrest and fatherlessness with Dr. Stephen Baskerville, author of a recent column for Chronicles Magazine, Revolt of the Fatherless. Dr. Baskerville, you had spoken earlier about how fatherlessness enters the middle class. Go into a little more detail about what happens when that occurs.
Well, there again, if you look at what happens in the middle class, you know, young people are turned into this, you find the same kind of havoc, the same kind of social enemy as you find, as we've been accustomed to see for decades in the inner cities. Young people become criminals, they become drug abusers, alcohol abusers. We can see this in the school shootings. I mean, many of those, the people perpetrating that come from middle-class homes. So it's the same problems we see elsewhere. And so it's no longer limited to poor. If you look at where did this leftist takeover of the United States start? It started in the inner city with George Floyd and a kind of incident where he died in circumstances which are not unusual in the inner city. You had revolts of young black men and women, and you formed organizations like, you know, Black Lives Matter. But look at who enabled that. It was done the white youths, the white middle class young people joined into that, and they took part of it. They enabled it. They made it respectable. They made it so it was no longer confined to the inner cities anymore, where it could be ignored. They spread it out, and they made it a general revolt against all authority, against history, against statues, against memorials, against everything, sacred in our society. You know, what was one time a problem of young, low-income minority youth destroying their own communities is now a problem of middle-class, white middle-class communities destroying their own communities and destroying our entire society, attacking our entire system of free government. So we can ignore it when it was in the black communities for decades, but we can't ignore it anymore.
Why is fatherlessness so debilitating?
That's a good question. I'm not a psychologist, and it's difficult to put into words that are, I don't like to invoke psychobabble, but it's very clear. If you look at the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, he equated fatherhood with civilization itself. He said that in the state of nature, dominion over children is with the mother. Because in the state of nature, in other words, the state of uncivilized life, you don't know who the father is. And so the mother is, has authority, exclusive authority over the children. But when there's a father, when you have matrimonial laws, in other words, when you have civilization with matrimonial laws, then the control of the children must be shared with the father. So Hobbes was essentially saying that the married two-parent family is equal, is tantamount, is coterminous with civilization itself. And so this widespread dyad of mother-child households with a father missing is basically, if Hobbes is to be believed, a return to the state of nature, a return to an uncivilized society. There's some other theories that are also very interesting. I quoted in my recent article a theory of psychologist Howard Schwartz, and he He invokes an interesting kind of neo-Freudian theory, which is he managed, I think, impressively to strip it of the hocus pocus and the psychobabble. And he explains that how, you know, many times in our early lives, we are very much attached to the mother, and we want to return to the womb. We don't want to go out into the world, engage with the larger problems of the world that's hostile to us. And the mother gives us unconditional love. The father's love is not unconditional. It's usually based on doing certain things, on achieving things. And we don't want to do that. So, you know, according to Schwartz and others have said something similar things, you know, when the father is not there, the father is the one that forces us to engage with the world, to accept the fact that our love is not unconditional for us, that we will have to be criticized. And if we want to be anything in this world, we will have to achieve. We have to achieve things, and we have to engage with the hostile world. You could have a whole discussion on that by itself. But I think in some ways it's interesting because Schwartz's theory is, as I say, it's kind of neo-Freudian, but it's also in some ways completely, I think, consistent with biblical principles, Christian and even Muslim principles, where the Father, the God the Father, is our supreme authority. There's a lot of room there for discussion. It's a fascinating topic.
Talk about what you call the deliberate and collective attack on actual fathers.
Well, yeah, I see this very strongly in our society today. The refusal, it starts in many ways with the refusal to face the issues that I'm raising here. The fact that, you know, the recognition, which is widespread, that fatherlessness is a serious, serious problem. This is beyond debate anymore. We all recognize this. But we also are faced with the situation of, you know, very powerful feminist groups, very powerful bar associations, very powerful welfare agencies that we don't want to challenge, and we're frightened of them. They're very, very powerful, and they are making money, and they exist on the right of the spectrum as well as the left. I mean, there's a lot of Republican conservative lawyers making a lot of money from divorce. So we don't want to deal with this. So what do? Well, we blame the fathers. Right, it's the fathers are abandoning their children. Why all this fatherlessness? Is it just impersonal forces? Is it just something we have to live with in modern society? That's hard to accept, and we don't want to challenge the family courts. We don't want to challenge the welfare agencies. So what do? Well, the only out there is to blame the fathers. It must be the fathers' fault. They must be abandoning their children, and this is completely false. But it's been very, very popular over the decades. If you look at back in the 90s, there were two very influential books that first called attention to the fatherhood crisis. And they were very good books in some ways. They described the problem very clearly. One was by David Blankenhorn, and it was called Fatherless America. And the other was by David Popenoe of Rutgers, and it was called Life Without Father, I think. And there were a number of others, but you know, those were two of the big ones. Both of them said, without any evidence whatsoever, the cause of all this fatherlessness is fathers abandoning their children. Well, they never showed a shred of evidence for that. In fact, I have challenged Blankenhorn in print to make good on that claim, and he has not been able to do it. He's not answered me, or he hasn't answered me with any plausible answer. It's turned into this attack, this demonization of father. They must be abandoning their children. That's the only reason for it. Well, as I say, there's no evidence whatsoever. And if you look at Sanford Braver's book, Arizona psychologist, University of Arizona psychologist, he makes it very clear. There's not a shred of evidence that fathers are abandoning their children in large numbers. So the fathers are demonized. And then, of course, there's the whole witch hunt that went on in the 90s and still going on today over deadbeat dads who not only abandon their children, allegedly, but also don't pay child support. Well, again, there's not a Braver has debunked this completely. Others have. I have. I've showed there's not a word of truth in this. But even worse than that, even worse than the mendacity, it leads to policies that are deliberately counterproductive. Because think about it. Okay, if fathers are abandoning their children, then the logical solution is to grab those fathers and force them to pay child support. That's the least you can do, right? If they've abandoned their children, you at least get a hold of them, you squeeze the money out of them, and you get them to pay for the children, so at least the children are provided for financially, if not with the moral authority of a father. But if the fathers are not abandoning their children, and they're not, then the child support system has a directly counterproductive effect. It doesn't provide for the children. It provides an incentive for more divorce and more fatherlessness. Okay, so if you're not only taking the children away from the fathers by force, but you're then forcing the fathers to pay for, as Jed Abraham puts it in his book, an attorney, Jed Abraham, he says it's a system for forcing the fathers to pay for the filching of their own children. And if that's what it is, then the child support system is providing incentives, financial incentives for mothers to divorce because they get all this tax-free money, which they control without having to share it with the father, and they don't even have to spend it on the children, and they have, you know, they get this windfall of you know, tax-free money, which provides a huge incentive for them to file for divorce. And not only that, but state governments have a huge incentive because they, and this is really diabolical, state governments actually make money on child support. It's difficult to explain. It takes take me a few minutes, but they make quite a lot of money, and they use it for general funds, general purposes. So state governments have a vested financial interest in encouraging fatherlessness. I mean, this is unbelievable that we allow this to happen. State governments get taxpayers' money on which they profit, and it is being used to incentivize to create more fatherless homes, more children without fathers. So it is the child support system is just absolutely diabolical. It does not provide for abandoned children. It creates fatherless children on a huge scale.
So how is the natural paradigm of father and mother attacked by radical sexual ideology? We'll find out how with Dr. Stephen Baskerville as we discuss social unrest and fatherlessness next.
Making Disciples for Life. Across the nation, students are back in school in over 1,800 schools serving children in early childhood through high school. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in a safe, caring, Christian environment taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Connect today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family at lcms.org/schools.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Terry Mattingly is the eternal boomer. In other words, he, due to the circumstances of his birth, is lame.
Here's some feedback from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Terry can be counted on to deliver his boring, blasé take in his irritatingly pseudo-profound fashion. Anyway, lame. May God have mercy on Terry and Issues Etc. You're all a bunch of lame boomers.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Stephen Baskerville is our guest, professor of state studies at the Collegium Intermarium in Warsaw, Poland. We're talking about social unrest and fatherlessness. So how is this natural paradigm of father and mother attacked by radical sexual ideology?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. And there's a number of ways, of course, directly and indirectly. But again, if you look at the demonization of fathers, you know, the allegations that you find that are rampant in divorce courts of domestic violence and especially child abuse, you can see that these are ways of undermining the family quite fundamentally. Take child abuse, for example. Fathers are often routinely accused of child abuse during divorce proceedings and by the welfare system, under the welfare system. And this is, becomes a way of getting the children away from them, keeping them away from their children, giving sole custody and oftentimes sole authority to the mother, and sometimes to the complete exclusion of the father. Well, if you look again at the statistics, where does child abuse take place? Child abuse is very rare in intact families. The vast majority of child abuse takes place in broken homes after the father has been removed, in single-parent homes. The vast majority of physical child abuse is perpetrated by single mothers. The majority of sexual child abuse is perpetrated by the paramours, by the lovers of the mothers, not biological fathers. Father-daughter incest is minuscule. The feminists make a big deal of it as if it's common. They write books about it, but it's very, very rare. So what are they doing? They're creating the very environments that are conducive to child abuse by removing the fathers, by allowing the fathers to stay in the home, by encouraging parents to stay together, the married father-mother home. The children, it's the safest place for children. It's also the safest place for women. There's very little domestic violence. Domestic violence takes place overwhelmingly in after the breakup of the home, after the, you know, the divorce has been filed. Both the real domestic violence and the false allegations, false accusations of domestic violence, which are rampant in divorce courts. These all take place during the breakup of the family because, of course, they play into the court case, the custody case. This demonization of men and sometimes even demonization of women, you know, this idea that married parents are all child abusers is just completely false. Married parents are the best protectors of their children. But increasingly, we get these welfare officials, social workers, child protection agencies moving against fathers, trying to remove fathers, sometimes taking the children not only from the father, but also from the mother. Sometimes we have many cases, documented cases, where mothers are pressured into divorcing the fathers. They don't want to divorce the father, but they are told, if you don't divorce the father and take out a restraining order and accuse him of domestic violence, we will take the children from you as well. Greg Ellis writes about this in his recent book, This Happened to Him, the Hollywood actor. So this is very common. So it's the demonization of the fathers, but it's also, you know, mothers are brought into this too. They lose their children as well. Once the father's been removed by the social workers, then oftentimes the social workers will take the children away from the mother also. There's many ways of this. I mean, I could list you all the cultural ways, but these are the most direct and horrific ways in which the social workers and they're backed by the judges, the family court judges, go along with this. There's usually no proof. There's no due process of law. There's no formal charges. Again, they're just the children are just taken on the word of the social workers, and it's ratified by the judges. And there's other ways. Homeschoolers are harassed by child protective agencies for the decisions they make about educating their children, especially if they're Christians. There's been a lot of cases about that, or parents who discipline their children are accused of child abuse in intact families when it's just ordinary parental discipline that would have been accepted 20, 30, 40 years ago. But nowadays it's called child abuse. So there's many of these things as well.
We spoke earlier about conservatives in action on this. Why have some conservatives also embraced this ideology of fatherlessness?
That's a good question. You know, I don't really know. I guess because I think in many ways it excuses their inaction. They're frightened. Many of them don't know how else to proceed. They are frightened. I mean, as I say, there's a lot of conservative Republicans who make money on divorce. There's a lot of conservative Republican women who are essentially feminists in some ways, right-wing feminists. And, conservatives are frightened of them. They don't want to stand up to them. Taking on the whole welfare bureaucracy, which is full, again, of radical women trained in radical feminism and men who are kind of sheepishly go along with it. This is a very daunting prospect, is taking on this. The bar associations and the family court judges are very well paid, and it's intimidating, the idea of taking them on. So, you know, the easiest way is to pick on people who can't defend themselves. And that's what I think a lot of conservatives do. They pick on the fathers. They got in the habit with the young black inner city fathers who had no way of defending themselves. I think it's regrettable. I think there's a grain of truth in the charge of racism there. I think some conservatives, not all at all, but some conservatives have nothing but contempt for young black men. And that's spread to the older middle class white men as well, now that fatherlessness phenomenon has spread to them. So it's the path of least resistance, and it's the easiest thing to do.
How has the state come to act as an all-knowing mother?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I mean, if you look at the bureaucracies who run this system, the family courts, the welfare agencies, I mean, they are all run, dominated many times by radicalized women. The family courts were basically created by the feminist bar associations. The system of no-fault divorce was devised by the feminist bar associations, and they originally created it back in the 40s, a long time ago. They didn't bring it in until the 70s because they couldn't get it through, but they were drafting these no-fault divorce laws back in the 40s. So in many ways, it is the matriarchy. The men are cowed. They're sheepish about standing up to it. And many of the institutions of our society are increasingly dominated by young, politicized, radicalized women, the law, the churches, the media, the universities, the Republican Party, the civil service, the public sector unions are increasingly feminized and matriarchal. So it's, you know, this has been growing for decades. If you go look at the profession of social work, it went back to Jane Addams at the turn of the last century. She was an anarchist. She was trained in Marxism and anarchism, and she imparted this to, you know, to the women that they were training as social workers. Later, it became women's studies programs in the universities. If you look back in the days before the welfare state, who ran charities? Who was it that operated charity? Well, it was, again, it was women, but it was mostly Christian women. It was Christian women who were supported by their husbands and who worked literally out of the goodness of their hearts among the poor. They had no vested interest, no stake in the matter, and they, you know, they ministered to the poor. What happened? Well, when you created a professional cadre, a professional core of professional functionaries, social workers, and welfare officials, you put those amateur women out of business, so to speak, and you created professional women who had a vested financial and bureaucratic interest in creating more of the problem which they were supposedly trying to solve. So it's, you know, you can see, I think a lot of it is answerable to the, you know, the professionalization of the social work industry and the bar associations and the family courts. So it's, you know, we're in this situation where there's this huge army of self-interested people who won't let go of this problem. I would also recommend you to the work of Janet Fiamingo. She's pointed this out in the context of the COVID, you know, emergency, the lockdowns and so forth. She says that in many ways, the, you know, the whole COVID thing played into this already existing idea of the state as the all-knowing mother. It discouraged male initiative. It discouraged men from getting out of the house. It put everybody in a domestic situation. It, you know, treated everybody like children who needed to be protected by the, you know, the all-knowing mother. And she's pointed this out. It's very, I mean, everything she points out already existed, but in some ways it was exacerbated by this this hysteria over the COVID crisis, the COVID epidemic.
Finally, how has the state been further empowered against fathers during the pandemic?
Well, let me first say that all of this empowers the state. I mean, it's well known. If you look at it, the two-parent family is in many ways in our society one of the greatest, if not the greatest, bulwark, limitation on the power of the state. Without the family, the state works directly on the individual. And with the family, you create a level of authority there, mothers and fathers, over their children, which breaks or limits the power of the state over the individual, or at least over the child. So when you separate fathers and mothers, when you set them at odds against one another, when the state claims to have direct jurisdiction or authority over other people's children, it does have very strong totalitarian potential, because there's no private sphere of life anymore. There's no, parents have that private sphere which they exercise authority and which they have the right to say to the state, you know, butt out. This is none of your business. This is not your turf. Unless you can accuse us of a crime, you have no authority within this household. We will run it as we see fit. We'll raise the children. We'll educate the children. We'll discipline the children as we see fit. And, you know, unless you have some serious accusation, you know, you stay out of it. Well, the breakdown of the family, the state, this gives the state, of course, an incentive to attack the family, to destroy the family, as we saw under the totalitarian regimes of communism and Nazism. They both attacked the private family. And so this is what we see again. Now, specifically the pandemic, again, I'm not an expert on this, but I would say that, the pandemic, again, it isolated people. It allowed the state to have control over people's private lives, over what they did, in their private time with their own bodies, so to speak. And, it made decisions for them. It discouraged initiative. It discouraged enterprise. It discouraged house family businesses were the first to be victims of the pandemic. It helped big businesses, corporations, often by putting family businesses out of business. So there's been a number of ways that small businesses, family businesses have been put out of business, disrupted horribly by the pandemic, but not by the pandemic so much, but by the government measures in response to the pandemic, often measures which have no real rationale to them. It's had a devastating effect, I think.
Dr. Stephen Baskerville is professor of state studies at the Collegium Intermarium in Warsaw, Poland. He's author of several books, including his latest, A Gentleman's Guide to Manners, Sex, and Ruling the World, and a recent column for Chronicles magazine titled Revolt of the Fatherless. You'll find a link to this column and to A Gentleman's Guide to Manners, Sex, and Ruling the World at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Baskerville, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Issues Etc. is brought to you in part today by Luther Academy, a confessional Lutheran worldwide mission outreach. Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications. Find out more about their work at lutheracademy.com, serving Lutheran pastors and lay people to the ends of the earth, lutheracademy.com. When we return, Pastor Jeff Hemmer will lead us in some teaching about fatherhood. He's author of the book Man Up. Then we'll talk about pro-choice attacks on crisis pregnancy centers with Patty Knapp, a certified pregnancy care counselor on Long Island.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.